This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the last weekend of January 2019. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week: the prospects of more state support for private schools.
It's not the slam dunk for the Republican leadership that other issues are.
Programs in Dallas and Williamson counties that offer young offenders an alternative to incarceration.
From a cost-benefit analysis, our program will be far less costly than a year of jail.
And who are the streets named after in the Highland neighborhood of North Central Austin?
Miranda, Esther, Lisa.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. A plaque in the Texas Capitol that was removed because it includes a statement historians have roundly rejected as false was the focus today of the government board that made the decision to remove the plaque. The Children of the Confederacy Creed includes a pledge to study and teach, quote, the truths of history, one of the most important of which is that the war between the states was not a rebellion, nor was its underlying cause to sustain slavery, end quote. Again, academic historians across Texas and the country have said that is false. The plaque was put up in the Texas Capitol in the 1950s as part of a backlash against the civil rights movement in the United States. KUT's Ben Philpott is here to talk to us about today's meeting. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
This is the State Preservation Board that met today. First of all, what is the State Preservation Board?
State Preservation Board essentially just runs the Capitol and the grounds around the Capitol. The State Capitol is kind of run as a living, working museum. They have artifacts from when it was very first built. And so you have a State Preservation Board to preserve and protect that Capitol.
Who's on the board?
It's made up of the governor, lieutenant governor, speaker of the House, a couple of lawmakers, and then a citizen member.
What did they vote to do today?
Well, they voted, you know, a couple weeks ago to take it down, and it's been down since then. Well, today's meeting was, okay, it's down. What are we going to do with it? And they kind of kicked the can down the road. They voted to delay the decision for 90 days. They're going to keep the plaque within the Capitol collections with the State Preservation Board. And during that 90-day period, they've, you know, let the public know, hey, write in with what you think, your suggestions, what you think we should do with this plaque.
And there were some people who had some suggestions today.
Yeah, even though they made that decision pretty much at the beginning of the meeting, they still allowed about 30 minutes of public comment on the steps that they had taken a couple weeks ago. Most of the people there were not happy about it, saying that you're erasing history. Yes, the Civil War was an ugly part of our history, but you can't just pretend it didn't happen. We are talking about monuments, or in this case, a plaque that not only is glorifying something, but is making false statements about that Civil War and the acts behind it. So, of course, the argument made to take it down was you can't leave up something that's just simply incorrect and around it had no information saying this is incorrect. It should be taken down.
What will happen with this plaque?
Who knows? Obviously, there are people who think it should be immediately put back up. One person suggested today that a photograph of it should at least be put up somewhere in the Capitol, and that also a picture of it should be put on the state webpage so that everyone can come to it and read it. But I think there is some disagreement. We had State Representative Rafael Anchia from Dallas who suggested that they should, and I'm quoting here, they should melt it down, just like the Terminator from the Terminator movies.
I remember that scene.
But then you had Eric Johnson, the state rep also from Dallas, who kind of led this effort to get it taken down. He's now running for mayor of Dallas, by the way. He said, no, look, it should be put in a university museum or just in an academic setting to study how this was created, why it was created, why did they put up the lies that are in it? What was the purpose of those lies? So he would like to see it studied.
Right. This went up in the 1950s, not immediately following the Civil War. There were some noticeable absences today, though, among members of the State Preservation Board. Who was not there?
Yeah, I told you that the lieutenant governor, governor, and speaker of the House are on the board, but none of them were there today. They all had people in their place representing them.
They don't like getting yelled at?
Well, you know, I think that certainly their schedules could have conflicted with this meeting. But yeah, at the same time, nobody likes to sit in a room for 30 minutes and get yelled at.
So 90 days to receive input from the public.
Based on the input that was received today, you know, that certainly could be a whole lot of you need to put it back up. But I think the cat's out of the bag on that. It's down. I would be surprised if the Preservation Board somehow decided that it should be put back up. We'll just have to see where that goes. I think it's interesting. 90 days still has it during the legislative session. I kind of thought maybe if they were going to kick it down the road, maybe kick it down the road till past the session so that none of them are here to deal with the public.
KUT's Ben Philpott joining us to talk about a meeting today of the State Preservation Board, where they heard from the public about the decision to remove the Children of the Confederacy creed from the state capitol. Ben, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Hundreds of people gathered at the Texas Capitol this week, on Wednesday to be precise, to call for more options for K-12 education. It was part of National School Choice Week. In the last few legislative sessions, lawmakers have floated bills that support charter schools, school vouchers, and homeschooling. But KUT's Claire McInerney explains that this legislative session is different.
Creating more alternatives to public schools has been a signature issue for Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick for years. Here he is in 2015.
To break the cycle of poverty, we must be sure every student graduates. And that means where we have failing schools, that those parents deserve change and they deserve a parent's choice to send their child to the best school they believe for their child.
Quick refresher. When politicians talk about, quote, school choice, they're talking about a few things. Encouraging more charter schools, helping traditional public schools create magnet programs, homeschooling, and then voucher programs. That's where the state gives a student money to attend a private school if they aren't happy with their public one. Voucher programs are often geared toward poor families who wouldn't be able to afford private school on their own. During the last few sessions, voucher proposals have divided lawmakers. House lawmakers, including some Republicans, refused to even vote on a voucher bill in 2015. So at the beginning of the last legislative session in 2017, Patrick urged his Republican colleagues to vote on the issue.
If you block a bill from a vote on school choice, you are blocking the future of that child.
Governor Greg Abbott echoed that request.
I hope and I urge that law reach my desk. And when it does, I will make the choice to sign it.
It's almost tradition at this point. Republican leaders spend the first few weeks of the legislative session calling for these so-called school choice bills. But not this year. Here's Abbott a few weeks ago talking about his priorities for the session.
That includes reforming our school finance system here in Texas. It includes reforming property taxes here in Texas. Also means
not on that list? Vouchers. Abbott, Patrick, and new House Speaker Dennis Bonin all say revamping how we pay for public schools is their priority. Bonin has said the House won't even consider a voucher bill this session. So why have they shied away from it this year? What changed?
The last election was a watershed, and that this has made Republicans more cautious in pursuing agenda items for which they don't have strong, majority support.
James Henson is the director of the Texas Politics Project at UT. He says the 2018 midterms revealed a few things to Texas lawmakers. There were many Republicans who found themselves in tight races, particularly in the suburbs, where they've had strong support in the past. Pair that with polling that shows only around half of Republicans support voucher programs.
It's not the slam dunk for the Republican leadership that other issues are.
Henson also says voters have made their demands clear. They want lower property taxes and better schools.
School choice doesn't really play a major role in either one of those for most people, despite the efforts of activists over the last 10 or 15 years to convince people otherwise.
Something called recapture plays a big role in this sentiment among voters, too. That's the system in Texas where cities with high property values are required to give a portion of their property taxes back to the state. You might have heard it called Robin Hood. The purpose is to help fund schools, mainly rural ones, and make the education system more equal. But places like Austin and Houston are paying half of their local property taxes or more to the state. So voters end up paying more taxes, but it doesn't help their local schools. And people have been very vocal about this, which could have forced leaders at the Capitol to switch their focus to school finance. But school choice advocates aren't giving up. Randon Steinhauser is an advisor for National School Choice Week and works in Texas. She agrees the way the state funds schools needs to be revamped, but she also thinks that can happen in a way that promotes choice.
The most simplest way to approach school finance would be that dollars follow the child, whether those dollars go to their neighborhood school or if those dollars go to a private school or if they go into an education savings account.
Steinhauser argues more money won't fix all the problems people see with their neighborhood schools, though she does support better pay for teachers and staff. While there haven't been any school voucher bills filed yet, it doesn't mean some lawmakers won't try to resurrect the issue before the end of the session. Claire McInerney, KUT News.
The long winter break for students at the University of Texas came to an end this week. Classes resumed, and as KUT's Trey Shaw reports, the new semester comes with some new rules for dockless electric scooters.
A task force of health, safety, transportation, and legal experts came up with a set of recommendations, some of which are now being put into effect. Just like bicycles on campus, scooters are supposed to be parked at bike racks or in other designated areas. The incentive for bike riders is preventing their bikes from being stolen. Now there's an incentive for scooter users. The university will impound scooters left where they shouldn't be, imposing a $150 fine that the scooter company can pass on to the scooter's last rider. Blanca Gomez is an assistant director for UT Parking and Transportation Services.
What we're really looking for is volunteer compliance with the users to make sure that they're not blocking doors, that they're not parking on ADA ramps or blocking egress or ingress, not blocking sidewalks or parking in parking spaces where they're not allowed.
UT will soon require scooter companies to limit the top speed of the devices to 8 miles an hour on campus. And while the university is not prohibiting students from using the scooters, faculty and staff are prohibited from using them for work-related purposes. Trey Shaw, KUT News.
Electric utility customers in Georgetown can expect to pay more on their monthly bills. And as KUT's Mills Michelle tells us, the city is blaming low electricity prices for its need to raise rates on customers.
Over the last few years, the city of Georgetown contracted to buy more electricity than its local customers need. Normally, a utility tries to sell that excess juice back to the grid for a profit, but the price of electricity has dropped since then. That leaves the city needing to make up the difference. To do that, officials are announcing a rate hike through this September. Now, a couple years ago, Georgetown made headlines by becoming the first Texas city to get its electricity from only renewable sources, but Jack Daly, an assistant to the city manager, says the rate hike could have happened regardless of that decision.
This increase is not necessarily tied to renewable energy. It's a issue related to how much energy we're contracted to purchase.
The Georgetown Electric Utility says the rate hike will translate to about a $13 increase to the average monthly bill. Mose Bouchel, KUT News.
Young adults placed on probation for felony offenses are more likely to reoffend and wind up in trouble with the law again than those who are older. Williamson County is one of two areas in Texas trying to reduce those numbers. KUT's Delia Jones reports.
The last time DeAndre Wade got arrested, he spent 2 weeks in jail waiting for a court date. He says no one knew he was in jail, so he wrote a letter to his uncle and gave it to a security guard. Then he went to pray.
And not even 2 minutes after I got up, the security guard told me I had a visitor. But that nobody knew I was in jail, so I didn't know who my visitor was.
It was his lawyer offering an alternative.
In my mind, I was like, well, damn, I just prayed for this. So I signed the papers.
The papers were something called the Second Chance Community Improvement Program, or SCIP. Young adults between 17 and 30 years old charged with nonviolent felonies or misdemeanors can qualify. It targets Dallas County's four most impoverished and heavily minority zip codes. The program includes individual counseling, access to services, and help finding a job or an education. If they finish successfully, their charges are dismissed.
It was too good to be true, but I would get out the next day.
That was in 2017. Wade's 21 years old now.
In the beginning, I wasn't too bright.
Wade said he would miss appointments, fail drug tests, and lie.
When you lie to yourself. So.
In 2014, while young adults were just 11% of the population in Texas, they accounted for almost 30% of arrests. And according to the state, 75% of young adults involved in the justice system were reincarcerated, the highest rate of any group.
our current criminal justice system is really failing these individuals.
Elizabeth Heineke is the executive director of the Lone Star Justice Alliance. It's a nonprofit working with SCIP programs in Dallas and soon another diversion program for young adults in Williamson County.
This is a very high need population. So it's a population with incredible numbers of housing instability, challenges with workforce and education, challenges with trauma, and challenges in general with mental health.
But research shows that when communities provide services to young adults involved in the criminal justice system, it's more effective.
Kids are being saddled with felony offenses. It impacts their ability to work for this emerging economy. Therefore, it's really holding Texas back.
SCIP is aimed at changing that, in part by changing how participants interact with the criminal justice system.
You don't know why you need to vote? Give you an example.
Judge Stephanie Mitchell presides over SCIP's felony community court. It's the first of its kind in the county, and it's not held in an actual court building.
You're sitting in front of someone that says, I see all this stuff and I don't care because you committed this offense.
Mitchell sits at a table with a purse perched beside her. A participant stands in front of her. Tables are arranged around them in the room where law enforcement officials, parents, and participants sit quietly.
That's why it's important for you, of all people, to vote. You need to vote like your life depends on it, because it does.
SCIP participants are required to register to vote, but don't have to actually cast a ballot. But that doesn't mean it's not encouraged.
Because you know the SCIP is bigger than just a court program. You all know that this is an experience. And hopefully what it's going to do is going to change your thinking.
Melita Strong is the case manager for SCIP. She's a dark brown, middle-aged woman with a welcoming smile. She's worked on and off in social services in the criminal justice system for the past 15 years. SCIP has three phases: stability, motivation, and accountability. The first phase, stability, lasts 120 days.
You observe court. Then you meet with me. We do an assessment. At that time, it will be determined whether you need mental health services. Well, you're going to get all of that anyway. Substance abuse services.
Participants are given free physical exams, dental care, and help getting their driver's license. By the end of phase one, participants have to identify educational or employment goals. Then it's on to phase two, motivation.
So in phase two, they meet with me every other week and go to court every other week.
Now, they only need to go to court once a month, but they need to stay on track along the way. Participants can get sanctioned, failing a drug test, not showing up for court, not having a valid reason for not meeting a goal set early in the program. All can mean sanctions. It's kind of a point system. The more sanctions you get, the more community service hours you have to do, or you can be put in jail. Strong says SCIP used to be just sanction-based, but then they realized incentives work too.
So if you got 5 points for being late for an appointment last week, but then you went to register to vote, there go 5 points, you washed out.
So far, SCIP's results have been encouraging. More than 40 people have gone through the program, and none have reoffended. Elizabeth Heineke from the Lone Star Justice Alliance says those low rates are exactly what the study is aiming for. It also saves taxpayers money, which is what partially attracted Williamson County.
From a cost-benefit analysis, our program will be far less costly than a year of jail. And a lot of these individuals are going to face much more than a year of jail if they aren't diverted successfully.
SCIP's group sessions begin with everyone writing down their obligations on a calendar. Strong says it helps hold participants accountable. Then a few words of encouragement from SCIP's project manager, and afterwards, the games begin.
Ain't something kids get away with in school today.
That's DeAndre Wade, who we heard at the beginning of the story playing feud host Steve Harvey. Wade is scheduled to finish the program this June. He's in phase three right now. He works at a cafe and he's taking GED classes. Wade says he wants to go to trade school for audio engineering and become a music producer. But until that happens, he practices with apps on his phone.
Last time I had a computer was like 4 years ago. This last time I was messed around with it, but like that's really where my passion is, working with music and producing beats.
Melita Strong says what many of the people in SCIP needed was hope.
Direction, guidance, sympathy, empathy, an ear. The lines get really blurred sometime with the participants. They start looking at me like I'm their mother because they finally get a person in their life that they can trust.
Most participants in the program, she says, are dealing with trauma.
So much pain and just failure. You heard Judge say today, you don't get to quit us, but we can quit you, because they're used to quitting. They're used to giving up when it gets tough.
To wrap up each group session in Dallas, participants gather, hold hands, bow their heads, and pray. To close out, they squeeze their neighbor's hand to signify a spark being sent around the circle and say,
I see your greatness.
I see your greatness.
I see your greatness.
Williamson County Commissioners recently unanimously approved funding for staffing and countywide training for their Young Adult Diversion Program. Over the next 4 years, researchers will study the programs in both Dallas and Williamson counties. They'll look at outcomes like costs, recidivism rates, and more to see if these programs could be a model for the state and even the country.
All right, go away and be great. Help me clean up.
Dalia Jones, KUT News.
The Texas Attorney General and state health officials announced a new website this week aimed at educating people about the dangers of opioid abuse. It's part of an effort to curb the number of deaths in Texas caused by prescription painkillers. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports.
The website, which is called Dose of Reality, is modeled after a similar initiative out of Wisconsin. It's supposed to be an educational tool and resource for people who want to safely discard excess painkillers they get from medical providers. Opioid addiction, which often starts with the misuse of prescription painkillers, has killed thousands of Americans in the past several years. Mark Rylander, a spokesperson with the Attorney General's office, says they're hoping this new tool can be used to prevent future addictions and death.
The reality is that this is the hour when the resources were made available, and we were able as the state, representing the state, to put this website there as a resource and a help and hope for people in Texas.
Rylander was asked if the AG's office was seeking more marketing funding from the legislature to spread the word about this education campaign. However, he said he was unable to confirm whether that was going to happen this year. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
Austin's nonprofit fundraiser, I Live Here, I Give Here, has a new boss. And as KUT's Jimmy Moss reports, she wants to make Austin one of the top cities for philanthropy nationwide.
Courtney Manuel took over as executive director of I Live Here, I Give Here this week. The organization helps raise funds for more than 700 nonprofits in Austin. The city ranks 33rd nationally in philanthropic giving, according to I Live Here, I Give Here's website. It trails 4th place Dallas, 5th place Houston, and even 25th ranked San Antonio. Manuel says if more people get involved, the whole city will see the payoff.
Education is very important. And once our community is informed and it's willing to step in and help to make Austin more generous, we'll continue to raise more and more money each year.
The organization hopes to raise $11 million in its annual Amplify Austin campaign, 24 hours of giving that starts on February 28th. Jimmy Moss, KUT News.
We get a lot of questions for our AT Explained project about the origins of street names around Austin. And it's no surprise, a lot of us drive by the same roads every day, and you sometimes can't help but wonder, how did these names come to be, and what do they tell us, if anything, about the place we live? KUT's Saida Hassan takes a look at the origin of street names in one North Austin neighborhood.
Recently, we got a call from a listener named James Arnold. James was curious about the names of some of the streets in the Highland neighborhood off of St. John's Avenue in North Central Austin. He noticed that a lot of the streets were named after women.
Miranda, Esther, Lisa, Rufus, mostly women. I think Rufus is the only one that's a male.
James wondered who Miranda, Esther, and Rufus were, and whether they'd played a role in shaping the neighborhood. One day, while getting a slice of pizza, he got to talking with the shop owner who had grown up in the neighborhood. She told him that those streets were named after children who died in a fire at the old St. John's Orphanage. James was curious whether there was any truth to this story, so he asked the same question about the origin of the street names in the Highland Neighborhood Facebook group. He didn't mention anything about the fire, and James got several responses from his neighbors saying they'd heard the same story.
I didn't even know that this was the land of a previous orphanage or just the history behind that. So, you know, it just made me really interested in kind of what the history was.
The neighborhood surrounding St. John's Avenue has a rich history. Its origins date back to the late 1800s. A group of Black religious leaders called the St. John Regular Baptist District Association bought more than 300 acres of land there. They opened a school and an orphanage. Eventually, after the Great Depression, the association decided to divide the land into individual plots and sell it to families who needed a place to build their homes. The St. John's Orphanage shut down in the 1940s. To find out whether there was any truth to the neighborhood legend, I decided to zero in on two of the streets James asked about, Miranda and Brenda Drives. I combed through old building permits and plat filings, and I found out that Miranda and Brenda Drives were named in 1962, 6 years after the orphanage burned down. So I wondered, could there be truth to the story that these streets were in fact named for children who lost their lives in the fire? Well, it turns out that's not possible. When the main building of the orphanage burned down in 1956, it had already been shut down for several years. News reports from the time show that no injuries were reported in the fire. And unfortunately, city records don't give any indication of who Miranda or Brenda may have been, whether they were people who lived in the neighborhood, or whether they were names that the neighborhood developer thought up on a whim. But one thing's for sure, rumors about the orphanage have been a part of the neighborhood folklore for decades. Before the fire in 1956, it was commonly accepted that the abandoned orphanage was haunted. People reported hearing eerie sounds coming from the building at night. Teenagers used to dare each other to go ring the old school bell at the front of the building at midnight. Authorities were unsure of the cause of the fire, but once the orphanage burned down, residents were convinced the ghosts were gone. As one article from The Statesman puts it, unless ghosts can stand roaring hot flames in the bright light of a blistering August afternoon, the old St. John's Orphanage is no longer haunted. The St. John's neighborhood today, you'd probably never know what used to be here. So many of Austin's oldest Black neighborhoods are facing change and redevelopment, and their history is not always apparent to people who live in the city today. James Arnold told me that when he walks through the Highland area today, he can't help but wonder what stories from the past he and his neighbors may be overlooking. They've been talking about ways to honor that history.
You know, I was talking about, you know, bronze, you know, statues of children playing in a splash pad or something like that. I mean, just something to really show what this area was meant to be for the African-American community at that stage in history. And again, it's just really rich history that would be nice if it wasn't buried.
Because one thing this story tells us is that when we leave gaps in history, people will fill them with their own stories. Saida Hassan, KUT News.
That's KUT Weekend for the last weekend of January 2019. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. You can email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org, or you can ask me on Twitter. I'm at KUT Nathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. ¶¶